We're delighted to be with Neil Gabler here on The Paula Gordon Show. Neil Russell gave you the opportunity to talk about Colossus with Walt Disney. America being a colossus in the world, sometimes a bully, sometimes a good guy, mm-hmm. makes the Walt Disney story a lot bigger than just, you say, oh, I write about America. Mm. When you write about Walt Disney, you're talking about certainly the industrialized world, but in a very keen sense, you just can't go much of the world without knowing that those ears that belong to Mickey Mouse mean something.
Well, he's an American figure. There's no question about that. You know, there was an earlier biography by Bob Thomas, a popular biography, called Walt Disney, an American Original. And I kind of take exception to that in my own book by saying, no, he really wasn't an American original. He was a quintessential American. He was a kind of an American everyman. You know, if you look at his life, there's a kind of novelistic pattern to it. He's born at the turn of the century, the turn of the 19th and the 20th century. He's born in the Midwest. You know, he migrates
the
American heartland. He grows up on a farm because his family moves from Chicago, urban Chicago, to this farm in Marceline, Missouri. He migrates to California. I mean, in some ways, that's the archetypal American story.
And his father moves the family to a farm because he's very suspicious of cities.
Exactly.
And that's very much part of the American tension between the city and the country.
Oh, yes. I mean, he looks at the values of the rural community and says, I want to raise my family in these values. And Walt Disney, you know, kind of imbibes those values. And indeed, that five-year period that he spent on that farm in Marceline becomes the touchstone of almost his entire life. And in some ways, one could say, without being too heavily psychological about it, that Walt Disney spends the rest of his life trying to find his way back to that Tom Sawyerish existence that he had in Marceline, Missouri. But having said all of that, as you said, Paula, nevertheless, Walt Disney resonates with everyone. And I think he resonates with everyone because the subtext of all of Walt Disney's work, whether it's the animations or the theme parks, is the notion of control and perfectionism. Walt Disney is an obsessive perfectionist. He is a man who wants to control the world. He lived, despite what I just said about that halcyon period at Marceline, Missouri, what he regarded as a somewhat Dickensian existence, because they move from that farm in Marceline, the Disney family, to Kansas City. They're back in that urban environment. And Walt is forced to deliver newspapers, for his father's newspaper route. His father owned a newspaper. That was his father's job in Kansas City, and it's every bit as demeaning as it sounds. And Walt would wake up 40 years later in a cold sweat in the middle of the night having nightmares about, oh, I forgot to deliver that newspaper. My dad is going to beat me.
And his dad had.
You know, the first line of my book is Elias Disney, Walt Disney's father. Elias Disney was a hard man. Truer words were never said. He was a hard man. And Walt grew up in this hardness so that he was always looking for a way to create his own world, a world that was controlled by him, not by Elias Disney, a world in which he could immerse himself imaginatively. Now, that notion of control, in my estimation, you know, resonates clearly with Americans who live in this whole kind of perfectionist bubble. We were the city on the hill, you know, early on in our existence.
Can we add delusional bubble?
Yes. Oh, of course.
just
checking. And Walt Disney played to that. But the rest of the world also plugs into the notion that the world will bend to our will. And I think people vicariously got that sense in Walt Disney's animations and in his theme parks that the world would bend to Walt Disney's will, and therefore it may bend to ours as well. When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come to you. Boy, is that not a resonant theme?
And we can all sing it.
That's right.
You know, talking about his growing up, which is obviously mm-hmm. central in this, one of the things that I came away from this with, which was in Disney, in some ways, is a tribute to what one can do without an education.
Oh, yes.
He's also an object lesson in what the limits that you run into mm-hmm. without having that education, because in many ways, the appearance to me is that a lot of the frustrations and his inability to, in many ways, to empathize. I mean, he's very good at reading the popular culture. He was much less good at working with the people around him.
Oh, yes.
But I think a lot of that was just an absolute failure of education because he simply didn't have the intellectual predicates, the experience, the tool set, to be able to see that his idea of perfection was not necessarily universal.
But, of course, one could look at it the other way and say that Walt Disney would have accomplished nothing if he didn't have those blinders on. You know, Walt Disney was a man, unlike most people of his generation and of his stature, who did not have education. And again, I think back to the first generation of Hollywood moguls. Most of them had a certain sense of deprivation and a sense of inferiority, that they hadn't been educated. Walt Disney, interestingly, never suffered a sense of inferiority. I mean, this man was absolutely self-confident, had total belief in his mission and in his vision.
And his mission and his vision were?
Were creating a perfect world. Now, that perfection manifested itself in different ways. I mean, early on, it was the Mickey Mouse cartoons. But when Walt was making those Mickey Mouse cartoons, he very quickly tried to elevate them from the contemporary cartoons of the time by inserting things like what we call secondary effects. Seeing what happens to the hair on a character when a character moves, or seeing the way that the wind reacts to clothing, or seeing the way that the mass reacts to gravity. These are things that no animator ever cared about. You know, the mouth moved, and if somebody ran, the legs moved. But nothing else moved. Walt Disney was interested in creating a sense of realism as a means of creating a more fully realized world.
Yeah, but it was realism with tongue-in-cheek. It was realism, but it wasn't real.
Well, that's right. He called it a caricature of reality. He understood that it wasn't photographic reality. So it was a caricature of reality. But nevertheless, it was Walt's way of dominating the world, again, of bending the world to his will. Now, a more educated man might not have had the kind of perseverance or the bullying element that he had, because you said, you know, he didn't work well with his employees, and he didn't, because he didn't see them as collaborators. Walt was not a collaborative man. Walt saw them as facilitators. You know, the animators were not artists in their own right, in Walt's estimation, though in most of our estimations they were, but Walt saw them as people who would facilitate what was in his head. You know, there's a great story about Snow White, that Walt would tell the story of Snow White repeatedly, again and again and again, sort of like the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. You know, I mean, he just never would let go of that story. Animators would see him walking down the hall and they'd turn the other way because they didn't want to be collared and hear the story of Snow White again. And yet the reason he did that, in my estimation, was that he was running that story through the projector of his head and making all the kinds of corrections and edits in that story that he would then give to his animators, which is why he told it repeatedly, so that they would understand what was in Walt Disney's head and they could get it on the screen.
Because he couldn't explain it.
No, he couldn't. He could tell it, but he couldn't explain it.
He could act it, too.
He could act it. He was, you know, when Walt Disney left for California, he said, there are two career options for me. I could be an artist or I could be an actor. And Walt never really left the idea of being an actor. He was a consummate performer. And you know, if you see, and I have seen, there's one snippet of film of Walt Disney voicing Mickey Mouse. Now, a lot of people don't know that Walt Disney was that falsetto voice of Mickey Mouse until 1946. But there's this snippet of film, and Walt was very self-conscious about it. That's why there's only a snippet of Walt voicing Mickey, and he doesn't just voice Mickey. He becomes Mickey Mouse. I mean, you see him, his body language, the way he tilts his head, you know, all of it is the very personification of Mickey Mouse, not just Mickey's voice.
You have a line in there on that subject that I just looked up. The eternal promise of cheerful solipsism.
Yes.
Which is precisely, to me, you know, you use it with respect to Mickey Mouse, but it really is a description in many ways of Walt Disney.
It certainly is. You know, Walt identified very closely with Mickey Mouse. It's one of the reasons he voiced him. He tried other voices, and no one satisfied him, so finally he said, I'm going to do the voice. But there is no question Mickey Mouse was Walt Disney's alter ego. And if Mickey Mouse is, you know, the embodiment of cheerful solipsism, so is Walt Disney. Walt Disney lived within his own world, within his own head. Even when it came to his family, and he was a very doting father to his two daughters, but even so, the family was not the top priority. The top priority was always the studio. And if you go to Walt Disney's office even today, and it's barren now, but if you go down that hallway in the animation building at the Burbank studio, there is his office, but then there's an anteroom, and it's got a bed, and it's got a shower, because Walt Disney literally lived at the studio for much of the time. And if you go to Disneyland, many people know that above the firehouse at Disneyland, there is an apartment. Also, it has been preserved, where Walt Disney would live when he visited Disneyland. His life was dedicated to his studio and then to his theme park. His entire life was dedicated to purveying his vision of the world.
Neil Gabler has written Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination. Bill Russell will have a chance to continue as I lead us out of this segment, and we come back in just a moment with more of The Paula Gordon Show. Be with us, please.